Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very pleased today to welcome Keir Milburn to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Keir is a British writer, activist and lecturer in political economy and organisation at the University of Leicester. He has a special interest in generational politics and is the author of Generation Left, exploring the large-scale move to the left by young people in Britain. Keir's research also explores the potential for progressive governance, in particular public commons partnerships, as a means to socialise the way we process economic decisions. So thank you very much, Keir, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very interested in seeing what we're going to discuss.
Yes. Well, I sent over those questions, but they were just to mislead you. I have a completely other agenda. No. we'll just see how we go. I mean, the work and research you've been doing overlaps a few key areas that are of central interest to this podcast. Work on governance, work also on social movements and politics, and you're very involved in that. And I'm very interested to get your view on the current situation. Can you just maybe just set the scene a little bit and talk a little bit about your background and what your current work focus is, Keir?
Yeah, well, it depends how far you want to go back in my background. I sort of grew up in the 1980s in Wales and up the Welsh Valleys. And if I, yeah, it's probably relevant. And so that, like, you know, the 1984-85 miners' strike was probably a pretty formative moment in my worldview. If I look back on it,
yes,
I grew up in a valley, the next valley across from the miners' hall in the film Pride. If you've ever seen the film Pride,
right?
About the letting gay support the miners. I'm constantly telling my daughter, you know, look, that's the world I grew up in. You know, we exist in a slightly different world now.
Yes.
And then I've sort of been a political activist for, since the early 90s, in fact, to out myself. And so I've been like writing and been participating in social movements since that time. I'm also an academic. I teach political economy and organization at the University of Leicester. And my current work is a little bit scattered. It all fits into one project in my head, but in nobody else's. I published a book last year called Generation Left, which is about political generations, actually, but like departing from the current generation gap, the political generation gap, which was really, really prevalent, actually, in the election just before Christmas, as it was in 2017, actually. So we'll probably talk about that a little bit later, you know, about what that means. What does it mean that age is actually like the key distinction between the key dynamic? Well, in the general election just before Christmas, you know, the age was the big difference, right? The huge difference in voting intention amongst the youngest to oldest. In 2017, this just emerged almost out of nowhere, right? This gap, and it emerged, and it's almost like a straight line. So in the 2017 election, it was for every 10 years older than 18 you were 9% more likely to vote Conservative. So 18 to 24-year-olds voting 75%, perhaps a little bit higher for the Labour Party, you know, and like, you know, 15-20% voting for the Conservatives, and the opposite at 65, over 65s, right, the opposite dimension, 75% voting for Conservatives, 20% voting for Labour. Those were both totally true, both in 2017 and 2019. But in 2017, it was a complete straight line. You know, every 10 years older, you just went straight up. And the only difference in 2019 was there was a drop-off of support for the Labour Party amongst 50 to 60-year-olds.
Yes, well, I'd like to come back to some of those issues. Certainly,
we'll come back to that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I mean, clearly there are no shortage of worrying environmental and indeed other crises facing us. I'm just wondering what is on your mind and keeps you awake at the moment.
Well, yeah, it is the climate crisis, the scale of the climate crisis. But if I'm honest, what keeps me awake is I get kept awake when you sort of start feeling impotent in the face of that. I basically try to deal with most things in a sort of political strategic sense, which gives me some sort of like agency over them. Do you know what I mean? And so I can sleep safely, even though the prospects for mankind are actually very, very worrying. It's those times when, well, look, you know, just after the election, I had a few sleepless nights because, you know, it's that feeling of sadness. In a, I could be specific about it, sadness in a sort of Spinozan sense. So sadness is like, you know, this, the feeling of your diminishing your ability to affect or be affected by the world. And that feeling generally diminishes because, you know, the sense of connectedness of other people breaks down. Do you know what I mean? It's the opposite of joy for Spinoza. Joy is that feeling that comes when you connect with other people in a productive way, and therefore you feel as though you have more of an ability to affect the world or be affected by the world. And, you know, it's sadness that keeps me up at night. And of course, those dark midnight hours are those when sadness sort of creeps in. Do you know what I mean? So I think it would, if I'm honest, I'd put it that way. The climate crisis is something which we carry around with us all the time, but we normally just keep it just out of view. Do you know what I mean? Perhaps just behind this left ear here, right? And then at night it creeps into view, and you think, oh, good God, we're in serious straits.
Yes, well, I have a little bit more juggling to do on that front here. Coming back again and again to these questions here on the podcast. I think I saw maybe in some of your social media or some of your writing something about this idea, but you know, that the climate crisis or global warming impacts all our political projects or impacts our political projects, certainly in terms of the time frame and so forth. I'm just wondering, could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it depends who all our political projects, because the point is, I think most political projects are basically in effect climate change denialist projects, because we find it almost impossible to face up to the level of transformation that like the scientific consensus implies is necessary. Do you know what I mean? I think we could put it this way, right? I think there's a gap at the moment between the necessary and the possible, right? So like what is necessary to do, the level and scale of transformation that's necessary to do, it's not set outside of human intention, but like, you know, it is conditioned by these physical attributes of you know, the carrying capacity of the atmosphere, et cetera, you know, which basically doesn't care about our feelings, if you like. You know, and if you look at like the work of people like Rockstrom or Kate Raworth, who come up with these ideas of a safe and just operating space for humanity. They sort of map the nine Earth system processes upon which continued human civilization depends, and say these are the points at which we will move beyond the stable state of those processes. Therefore, any social and economic order you need needs to fit within this safe operating space for humanity. The point is, we are not headed there, right? And in fact, from current, you know, our current view of what is socially and politically possible, it is impossible to get there, right? There's a gap between the necessary and the possible, right? The possible is something which you can act on and change, right? That does depend on, to a much larger extent, on like, you know, human action, etc., right? But we have a very constrained conception of what it is possible to do. You know, we can look at the Labour leadership election, and we could read it through that. You know, we everyone's starting from the wrong point there. You know, we know where we need to go to, or the rough coordinates of the sorts of society we need to get to, and we can sort of backcast from that, right? We can sort of backcast from that and rethink. Okay, so there are intermediate stages we need to get to, and then we can forecast from what is currently possible. But you know, the point is, we have to bridge that gap between the necessary and the possible, probably in an iterative way. Do you know what I mean? And what I mean by that is that we need projects which change conditions, and those change conditions set up the possibility to go further. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes. And I think that's very interesting, because we talk about political projects, but you know, the degree to which the intersection between social and social political projects, social change, political change, we've seen, you know, the left comprehensively defeated in the recent general election here in the UK. And, you know, it's just a brutal and cynical strategy of the Tories, where they don't even turn up to a debate on climate change. They just don't even turn up. You know, it was such a hugely important, you know, existential question we're facing. So it does bring up this question. I know you've thought about this over some time. The role of, I guess, you know, cultural activism, countercultural movements on social change, given in particular some of the deadlock we've seen in political terms and regression in America and indeed in the UK and some of the structural impediments that are just there.
Yeah. Well, because one of the other projects I'm involved in, or the political project, is this. I do a podcast myself called ACFM, which comes out on Navarra Media. And it revolves around this concept of acid communism, which is Mark Fisher, who's a social theorist, one of his ideas. And we were playing around with the idea of acid Corbynism. I'm not sure if that name's going to survive anymore. But it's very much about this idea of like what thinking through cultural activism, countercultural movements, and looking back to the countercultural movements of the late 1960s, early 1970s, really into the 1980s. I sort of grew up in the sort of like that post-punk culture of the early 1980s. Do you know what I mean? It really, really formed me, that the sort of the expectations of what a good person would be, what an interesting person would look like, really has informed the rest of my life, really. You know, and it would be this thing of like, you know, that post-punk era was very much an era of like, you might talk about it as like working class autodidacts. Do you know what I mean? Very much like, you know, I grew up in the South Wales valleys, and like, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, you know, that was the pinnacle of like working class culture around the world, the mining communities of that, and then sort of like the drive for self-education, but not self-education as a way to escape your class, but a way to improve the class as a whole. Do you know what I mean? I see those two eras as sort of, in some way, have similar sort of like sort of the subjectivities that they develop out of them. And so basically our ACFM project is looking back at those eras and thinking about, you know, what lost futures that did those eras create, that they thought that those eras thought they were going towards, they didn't go towards. What could we reopen of those lost futures in some sort of ways? But I think that also relates to this age divide, because you did mention the generation. Especially in relation to climate change, I find it really hard not to look at this election that's just gone and think, basically, people chose fantasy and denial and looking away as against, you know, facing up to the problems that we're and the crises that we're in the midst of. Do you know what I mean? Especially because Labour often is Green New Deal, you know, lots of other sort of, quite innovative policies, which, you know, no matter what you thought of them, they were genuinely trying to face up to a whole series of crises that have been going on for a long time, but like I've just been in crisis mode at least since 2008. Do you know what I mean? The financial crisis of 2008. And it's sort of like we basically decided, or the country decided, or perhaps it'd be better, the property pensioners decided not to face up to those, right? And so to complicate that little picture I'm giving is that, like, the reason that we and the ACFM crew are so interested in the 1960s and 1970s was because we think now there is a left generation. Young people have shifted decisively to the left, and they are trying to work out what the relevant ideas for this moment are, right? And the last time there was a nascent left generation was in the 1960s and 1970s, right? And that they basically, that generation, which are also called the boomers, they got defeated. That's what neoliberalism, that is the defeat of the boomers in the 1980s and 1990s primarily. You know, and so that's got a couple of consequences. One consequence is all of the problems that 1960s, 1970s left generation formed around went unresolved because they were defeated and are now lingering around. We have the return of the repressed. They're lingering around in unresolved form with 30 years of intensity built into them. The most obvious one is the climate crisis, right? The concern with ecological issues was this tiny marginal concern in the 1970s being produced by this left movement now is an inescapable problem, right? But also, you know, you could just look at like, you know, what were the other things that the other problems that boomer generation were trying to grapple with, that the left boomer generation were grappling with. One of them was anti-colonial struggles, Vietnam, et cetera, you know, which basically just did not get resolved with then going to globalization, et cetera. You know, and what and how does that come back now? It comes back in, you know, the rise of the right. You know, right iterations of that is basically, you know, those colonial countries that they did not get self-governance in any sort of meaningful form, and then we have flows of migration flowing from both that and the ecological crisis. Do you know what I mean? And I think the other thing that they formed around, though, that 60s, 70s generation formed around, was that there was a glimpse of freedom, actually, right, in that period. It was a sort of freedom that comes out of the social democratic compromise from the 19 of the post-war era, basically, where you get the welfare state and you get some sort of suspension of the link between work and destitution, right? Perhaps the first time in human history, right? For a significant part of a population in particular parts of the world, you know, if you didn't have a job, that didn't mean that, or you decided to work less, that didn't mean that you'd be destitute, right? And in those sort of circumstances, you get things like cultural experimentation, huge cultural confidence, etc. You know, it's not surprising we're completely obsessed with the movement of the 1970s and 1980s. You know, freedom has material preconditions to it, you know, and I think those were there in that time. And I think that, in fact, Mark Fisher, he wrote a little an introduction to it, to a book he never managed to complete. Unfortunately, he killed himself a couple of years ago. He wrote that, like, we can understand neoliberalism in the last 30 years as actually just all about warding off that glimpse of freedom that was produced in the 1960s and 1970s. I think he calls it like a world in which we could be free, or a world without domination, right? That was the sort of glimpse of freedom in the 1970s, and it survived in a sort of like, it's haunted the last 30 years, and it seems very, very attractive to young people now, and which is why you can see things such as, you know, this four-day working week being given real prominence when it, and in fact being, you know, passed up as policy, in fact, by the Labour Party, when just 2 years ago that would have been so far out of the mainstream, it would have been laughed out of town. Perhaps it was laughed out of town in the election, but among young people it's very attractive, you know.
Yes, yes. What do you think are a few lessons from the 1960s? A big topic, but before we move on, something you've thought about clearly. And I guess it's interesting, you know, the degree to which I guess young people see, you know, political change as a possibility, and the degree to which they have come out of this election, in the UK at least, you know, in some way damaged, or in some way, you know, more aware, more energized to you know, to continue to, you know, fight for what they believe in, but through other means, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see, won't we? Because this is that election was the first sort of experience of defeat. Well, I don't know if that's actually true for Generation Left. Anyways, it was. I don't know if it's the first, but it was an experience of defeat. I mean, if you just look at like the age and voting dynamics, you know, young people realise that they are outnumbered by the over 65s. I mean, Britain is an aging country. You know, the average age is just going up and up and up, because people are living longer, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, basically the older generation, the older generations have been, their material interests have been constructed to be on the right. Okay. In fact, we could link it back to this little story I was telling about how the boomers were defeated. Like the way they were defeated, there's two sort of waves to how they were defeated in the 1980s. The first one I witnessed up the Welsh Valleys in the miners' strike. They were defeated militarily. You know, the police went in there. I remember like had 30, 40 police vans in my town on their way up to go up to the mines. You know, that town was in occupation. So it was a militarily defeated, as in the unions were smashed with the full force of the state. But then what happens after that is basically the boomers got their mouths stuffed with gold. to paraphrase Bevan, I think it was Bevan said that, as in basically the council housing was sold off. So we have the privatization of this wealth built up by a previous generation. This public wealth is privatized and given, basically, because council housing was sold off with between about 30 and 50% discount on market price. So this is a giveaway. It's a giveaway. And what does that do? It starts a house price boom. It starts a house price boom, which is like accelerated because you have like the deregulation of finance. So basically wages have been basically stagnant in the UK, real wages, most measures, since like the mid-1980s. So people have not got richer by having more wages. Generally, you've basically got richer by having an asset which is inflated in price. And of course, that basically 2008, the crisis, which of course starts with a housing crisis, 2008 is the point at which young people who already have been cut out of that, being able to access any of that house price bonanza because house prices are too expensive, they are finally cut out of that, basically. And so you can see that material interests of older people has been basically aligned with the performance of the financial sector and the performance of real estate. If real estate and the financial sector are doing well, then material interests of propertied older people, so like 75 to 80% of pensioners own their own home outright in the UK. So there's 20 to 25% who are excluded from that and in real, real difficulties financially, of course. And young people's interests are constructed in the opposite way. If the financial sector is doing well, they're doing bad. If the real estate sector is doing well, they're doing bad. You know, the material interests of young people are linked to the level of wages and level of social spending. And both of those have been utterly catastrophic in the last 10 years. You know, the 2010s will be the worst decade for wage growth since the Napoleonic era, which is insane. But that's an epochal difference. You know what I mean? If you want to know why young people are moving to the left, your older people are moving to the right, that's at least a sort of starting point. I think the other place that where it divides, though, is because material interests only really make sense when they're tied to a sense of what is possible in the future, to return to that theme, right? Because, you know, it's my material interest to do this because in the future it will lead to this. Do you know what I mean? It's inherently linked to a sense of what's possible. And, you know, that defeated boomer generation, one of the effects of defeat is you do not think that radical change is possible, right? And, you know, that's because of the defeats of the 1980s, the fall of the Berlin Wall, globalized, all of that, basically. What is the third way left? What is Blairism apart from the acceptance that change is not possible? You know what I mean? And that is not the mindset of younger people. You know, they may be, they haven't gone through that experience of defeat, but they're also faced with this prospect that they know radical change has to happen, and it has to happen incredibly rapidly. And I think that's one of that's the distinction between the two. So I think cultural activism is absolutely crucial to crossing that divide. I don't know quite how it does it, really, but it's absolutely crucial to crossing that divide.
Yes. Well, what do you mean by cultural activism?
Yeah, and that's a good one. So what needs to happen? What needs to happen now is, I think I basically skipped that bit of your question, as in, you know, what do we do about this defeat? One of the things we need to do is that attention has to shift now from Parliament to extra parliamentary.
Yes.
It has to, because basically, you know, there's going to be nothing happening in Parliament, as in there's no power to wield in Parliament at the moment. And so, you know, it has to turn into trying to change the reality on the ground through sort of what you might call deep organizing. I want to talk about that. I mean, you know, trying to organize people into unions, into community unions. I'm a member of ACORN, which is it's a social union, but it sort of focuses primarily on housing and renters' rights, etc. And it's spread incredibly rapidly because that's the issue that you would focus on if you want to exercise power in that way. But also I'm talking about, you know, other forms of solidarity projects, such as social provisioning projects, food banks, etc. You know, that would be, that's sort of like the key in many ways, but that has to be linked to a hegemonic project, which by which I mean, you know, trying to change the sense of what's possible, you know, in, you know, through that world of Parliament and the media, et cetera, et cetera. That also has to be kept in in play with it, I think.
Yes, I'm interested.
I didn't mention culture, that did it? It didn't mention culture at all.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I guess the kind of stories. I mean, one of the I guess recurring themes you do hear just from the environmental perspective is people saying that analyzing the way the environmental movement has been communicating over quite a period of time, being very defeatist, being very negative, beating people over the head rather than creating what you're talking about, visions of the possible and so forth. Yeah. And I was wondering what kind of art, what kind of culture is possible in, dare I say, late stage capitalism.
Well, like I say, I may not be the best person to ask because my sense of what of like cultural movements is very much informed by that post-punk going into the whole acid house era. Do you know what I mean? Those did depend on certain material preconditions and a certain level of tolerance. Although, towards the 80s and through the 80s into the 90s, there was a constant sort of political and police crackdown on those sorts of movements. But one of the things we've been doing with in this sort of ACFM project is me and a friend Nadia Idle have been doing these workshops with basically they're consciousness raising workshops, and they just basically involve us getting a group of people together and getting them to try to talk about their own personal experience, basically talk about their own personal experience and move from that personal experience to try and think about how wider structural forces are conditioning those experiences. Do you know what I mean? So that's a way of trying to denaturalize this. That's a way of expanding possibility by saying, look, your life may feel constrained, but that constraint is not something that is internal to you or not necessarily internal to you and therefore unchangeable. It is linked to structural conditions and therefore in principle it's changeable. Do you know what I mean? And one of the ways to think about that is, one of the things that surrounds our lives today is this huge level of anxiety and depression as well, but anxiety and precariousness, etc. And so in some ways I think those sorts of practices of almost like degree zero politics, or where you get groups of people in the room to talk about their experiences and then link those experiences to structural causes in order to then be able to think about how you overcome those structural causes, that it's almost like the precondition for other forms of politics, right? Because you have to sort of we live such isolated, anxious lives. We have to reestablish the social. Do you know what I mean? We have to reestablish the social as a precondition to other forms of, perhaps even more antagonistic forms of politics.
Well, that's very interesting. And brings us to, I guess, one thing I'm interested in is the kind of Extinction Rebellion and other kinds of activities like that. I don't know to what degree you've been thinking about this and how effective their approach is. This may be a bit specific, but whether or not what have we learned since the days of Occupy, I guess. And I don't know whether you have thoughts on that, but maybe just touch on that, because you say about many different forms of expression, of cultural expression, and as you say, some will be more aggressive or more, there's different forms really.
Well, I'm going to go back before Occupy, because I was involved in the very early days of the climate camp movement, a camp for climate action, if you remember that. So the first camp for climate action was in 2006. I'm living in Leeds. I'm sat in Leeds now, and it was not too far away from me in Wetherby, this huge, the biggest power station in biggest coal power station in Europe, Drax. And so there was a camp outside, and then attempts to go and sort of blockade and stop Drax. I was sort of involved in that, and that went on through several iterations, and then it basically blew up in 2010 when I went to Copenhagen for the COP15, which is like the Conference of Parties, a UN meeting that happens every year. And we basically realized that we were at an impasse with this form of politics, because we couldn't exercise the sorts of power that would be needed. It was very much a bottom-up sort of direct action sort of movement, very much the tradition I come from And we reached this this level where we were at Copenhagen and thought, look, oh, what we're actually doing is militant lobbying of a load of governments, because they're the only ones at the moment who've got the power to act. And all of those governments there, they are completely uninterested in doing the sorts of change, or and probably unable, with the current balance of forces, to do the sort of change or transformation that's necessary. You know, and it was that sort of realization of, well, okay, then we probably need to do a different form of politics if that's the case. You know, that Extinction Rebellion has done loads of really good things. You know, it's really exciting in some sorts of ways. But basically, it has not faced up to that problem. It doesn't, you know, basically it's stuck at that level of awareness raising, militant lobbying of governments, right? It didn't learn the lessons of the climate camp. It didn't learn them very, very, you know, consciously didn't learn them, because the one of the guys who set it up, what's his name? I can't remember. My mind's gone blank. Anyway, you know, he said we shouldn't be listening to these people because, you know, they're addicted to failure and all this sort of stuff. You know, that's the impasse that Extinction Rebellion are at now, right? Because it's got a sort of anti-politics sort of anti-politics element to Extinction Rebellion, which I think is also, you know, viewable from the Occupy days as well, that sort of anti-politics. And it gets to that point of like, look, we need to move from that to like, how do we bring about this, the sort of the level of transformation that we need in this very, very short period of time? Do you know what I mean? And so I think that is a problem that I don't think Extinction Rebellion will be able to solve. But in many ways, we need to look, like, think about movements and the left, if you want to put it that way, you know, as an ecology itself, you know, an ecology of different organizations can do different functions. And if that ecology can be brought into some sort of productive relationship, then you can have change. Do you know what I mean? And so if you look at Extinction Rebellion, you know, their greatest success was probably getting the Green New Deal passed at a Labour Party conference. They would not see that. Many people involved that would not see that. But like, they set the conditions. They and Greta Thunberg, you know, the youth climate strikes, which are probably even more important, I think. They set the conditions within which, you know, the major unions felt it was not possible to block that policy, right? You know, that's a huge thing. Unfortunately, we lost the election, but it's still, you know, the Green New Deal now seems to be solidly on the agenda, you know, within the realm of like at least possible to discuss in politics, if not possible to put into place at the moment. That's a huge, massive, major victory by Extinction Rebellion that the climate camp didn't manage to do. Then again, the climate camp, you know, it came into being before the great the financial crisis of 2008, and before it fully started to have an effect, and therefore the possibilities for change were much more diminished than Extinction Rebellion's era, I think.
It's very interesting what you're saying. It also makes me wonder about this deep polarization that we're seeing, and we have seen, you know, you see it particularly in America. And, you know, and we've seen it here in the UK as well. And, you know, I think for a long time, there seemed to be a kind of an assumption of this, about, you know, communication about climate science, that there's a kind of cognitive deficit. If we just explain the information, if we get this information over to people, then it'll be fine. We'll, you know, we'll people will get on board. They'll realize that this is, you know, a major issue. And, you know, it's something we have to solve in a short time. And I think it's becoming apparent that, you know, people interpret information in very different ways, and that, you know, how depending on the values they hold and the wider social, political, you know, other factors like that. And, you know.
But also material interest as well. That's one of the things that doesn't get included, I think, in when we have these sort of talks, is that, you know, based the way people's material interests have been constructed, you know, it's not in their, it's in their material interest not to take this stuff on board. Do you know what I mean? And I mean that quite straightforwardly, as in, you know, at a certain point when, if we start to act on climate change seriously, and so basically there's going to be huge stock market collapse, right? Primarily because all of this fossil fuel companies, all of the oil companies, etc., you know, they are valued at the idea that they're all available.
The carbon bubbles
that go to be dug up and burned, right? That's what they're valued on. if you do that, then there'll be no one there. There'll be no one here to value anything, right? You know, at a certain point, that's going to collapse. I'm not saying that, like, you know, a property pensioner sat in his home in Hampstead is thinking about that, right? But it is that, you know, that is why, you know, the material interests of that pensioner sat in Hampstead has been constructed to be in alliance with some financial oligarch sat in the City of London, who is very aware of that. You know, he's very aware of the fact that, you know, they're playing a delaying game to try and grab as much resources as possible, knowing that this is not a sustainable situation. Do you know what I mean? The thing that happened last year that probably horrified me most was the big forest fires in the Amazon in Brazil. You know, I've got a Brazilian friend I'm speaking to, and he's saying, like, you know, I'm in Rio, hundreds of miles away from the Amazon. We can't go outside because of the choking smoke. Then we've seen Australia, etc. But the thing in Brazil that worried me the most was this was a deliberate policy of the government. You know, you've got a far right government, Bolsonaro, and his environment minister went to the miners and the strip farmers surrounding the Amazon forest and said, you know, you are Brazil's future. We are going to support you in whatever you do. And they said, right, great, we're going to go and burn the Amazon then. You know what I mean? It was that thing of the right have just given up on the future. It's all about we're going to grab what resources we can now and basically F everybody else. You know, that is one way which you can construct material interests. You know, that's what worries me. Like, there's a deep polarization, right? But that polarization does not mean that, like, those both poles have equal weight or are equally valid, or that, like, you know, that the truth lies in the middle of those two poles or anything like that. One side is based around the denial of the, you know, the fundamental problems that are facing humanity, right? You know, there's no possible future, right, in which future historians look back and say Bolsonaro was right. There's just no possible future. We know that. Right. There's only a possible future of looking back and saying, yes, the general election of 2019 was an absolute disaster. Yes, Bolsonaro was an absolute disaster for humankind. There's no possible future where that's not true. Do you know what I mean?
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. You're talking here about material interests and the importance of material interests. And I think, you know, people have commented upon the importance, I guess, the fragmentation of the left in terms of identity politics and the trying to get a common, you know, ground, find common ground with, you know, the gender issues and, you know, race issues and, you know, which are very important as well. And I'm just wondering to what extent, I mean, I've seen research in the States, at least, which really does tie in, you know, your political view, your view on climate change, you know, so people, for example, you know, and other sets of values that are very intertwined and maybe not so obviously material. I mean, and Naomi Klein, who I was talking to, talks a lot about this kind of evangelical, you know, religious kind of rapture based thinking that is around, you know, and Scott Morrison as well tied in with this, you know, this kind of thing. So I'm just wondering, in the United States, for example, you know, the people who don't believe in climate change, but they also don't believe in evolution, you know, and there are whole sets of clusters of, I guess, values that are, you know, that come together. And, you know, and Naomi Klein was very combative in terms of, you know, wanting to, you know, win the battle with these, you know, these groups and so forth. But I'm just wondering also about, you know, ways of working with people, you know, of different values. It was a quote, what's the quote, which I really liked, is kind of a version, I guess, of American pragmatism. What was it? Let me just see what I can find it here. I mean, I think the idea was that the real power of politics should not be about getting people to think the same thing, but people with different views want to do the same thing. That kind of idea. And, you know, it's a lot of conversations I have tend to get quite polarized and you know, on the one side and the other side, and looking at it in you know, and inevitably in kind of battles and conflictual terms and so forth. So this is an observation. I don't know whether you have any thoughts there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is why why I'm, I want to talk about it in terms of like material interest, because like material interests are not set, they can be constructed in different ways. Do you know what I mean? And material interests are not just about like, oh, is this going to put more money in my pocket? You know, a material interest also, it must include, you know, the obvious sort of like libidinal joy that the far right gets from owning the libs. Do you know what I mean? That is basically the motivating affect of like the far right to many, many degrees, is just to, you know, to feel a sense of victory over people on the left, etc. That you have to include that in material interests as well. But I think so, and so the whole of that can just go down to something like, you know, your social being, like it conditions your ideas or your values in some ways. Do you know what I mean? And so that means, you know, the sort of work you do, the experiences you have every day, etc., they will make you predisposed towards certain forms of values and certain forms of political articulation of those interests, and less disposed to other ones. But that is not an iron cage by any means. Do you know what I mean? And so, yeah, so the project is, you know, so for instance, about like, so the one I'm thinking about most, obviously, right, is this age divide. How do we bridge this age divide? You know, and you basically have to sort of break the reliance, the alliance of interest between older people and, you know, the financial sector, real estate sector, etc. You have to break that by offering different forms of material well-being, in particular like social care, right? Elder care is the thing that you're most concerned about when you're older. And I think, in fact, a lot of the attachment to like basically we want to defend high house prices is about that idea that like the only way in which most property pensioners see of ensuring they're going to get the elder care they need is to basically sell their house or to withdraw equity from their house and then use that on private health care. You know, you provide really good state health care and that just dissolves in a moment. Do you know what I mean? I mean, Labour tried to gesture towards that a little bit in the last election. So in principle, material interests can be reframed so that they are compatible with other people's material interests, right? And then on top of that, you have to give a political articulation, you have to give a political sort of story and way of understanding the world, which links those two material interests. You know what I mean? That's the sort of, that's basically what sort of politics is about.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you see social movements, what needs to happen? We've just come out of an election. We've, you know, this wounds and time to you know, to analyze and think and so forth and you know, come up with, you know, new ways forward. I mean, whether it's, you know, directly through the new leader of the Labour Party and so forth. I'm just wondering, in terms of momentum, keeping momentum in you know, after the election, you know,
yeah, what is that lack of a small M?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Probably both, right? Probably both. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's quite hard, isn't it? Because basically what's happened is that we've had our time scale of politics changed dramatically in the you know, over a, basically in 1 minute between like, you know, 9:59 and 10 o'clock that Thursday when the exit polls came out. You know, we were living in one political reality and then the next one comes along. And, you know, basically since the 2017 election, which is the real outlier, to be honest, right? That's the 2019 doesn't need explaining. That just fits into the general pattern of decline of social democracy around Europe. 2017 is the outlier. You think, why, you know, that needs explaining. Why did 2017 happen? A reversal of the long, long term trend of diminishing vote share for the Labour Party. But like 2017, that's basically it sort of forced everybody to think, there actually could be a sort of left-wing Labour government, you know, within 6 months. And so that really constricts the amount of time scale you're thinking in politics about, you know what I mean? And it's probably not healthy, to be honest. Now, there's not going to be an election for 4.5 years. There's just not. So now you can widen your scope a little bit. Do you know what I mean? In some ways, it's an utter disaster because those 5 years are incredibly precious. Right, in terms of like climate change, do you know what I mean? The scale of transformation needed and the time scale to enact that transformation, they're sort of inversely linked. Do you know what I mean? the longer we put it off, the more and more radical the transformation needs to get. You know, there could have been a very gentle transformation, a very reformist and gentle transformation if we'd have started to deal with it seriously in 1990 or even 2000. Now you just need an incredibly massive scale of transformation over a very short period of time, which is very hard to do. Anyway, it's disastrous in that way, but 5 years gives you time to then start thinking, well, what, you know, electing a government without a movement behind it is basically not going to work, right? To be honest, if Corbyn had won that election, that government probably would have been defeated in 6 months, right? And now we need to get into a position where there's a strong movement. And I think that's going to be around, I think it's going to be around building up, you know, this organizing strategy, changing focus from Parliament to wider society, to organizing solidarity projects, etc. And then that would be about, you know, the next election will be going into an election, basically saying, look, this is what we need to tackle climate change, you know. To all the non-Tory parties, to the Greens, even to the Lib Dems, you'd be saying, no, sign on for this. Sign on for this. Add your own ideas, but sign. This is what needs to happen, right? If you're not going to be a climate change denier, you have to accept this. Sign on for this, and we'll lead a progressive sort of alliance or a democratic alliance. You'd have to offer, say, look, we need to tackle climate change, and we need a radical democratization of society. Now, we need to do both of those at the same time. They're intimately linked.
That's an easy weekend's work. No,
five years.
Yes, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm mindful of the time, but it brings us to another interesting area. As you said, you have a variety of different projects that you're working on, and research interests. And I am interested, and I'd like to find out more about this kind of question of governance, democratic self-governance, and public commons partnerships. I know this is it's one area you've been researching. Can you just talk a little bit about governance? Talk maybe about the commons to begin with, and why they're important, and maybe because it ties in a little bit what you're talking about, this democratic in the real sense.
Yeah. Well, look, I'll get into that by saying, like, when I say this turn away from, you know, towards like extra parliamentary movements, etc., and organizing on a wider scale, it's going to be a turn away from that, but also to the municipal level, if possible, because that's still the level at which you can get Labour councils to try and do things. Do you know what I mean? And so that's one of that's the level of scale I'm thinking of in terms of this idea of public commons partnerships, which we'll come to in a moment. But so basically the core of like what you might call a Corbynist political economy, or it's probably more like a McDonaldist, actually, because John McDonald was most interested in it, was this idea of, people talk about it as democratizing work, or the institutional turn, it's been called as well. But this idea of changing the way that we govern institutions, and institutions govern us, changing the way that we do that in order to produce new possibilities. And so, like, perhaps the way to get into that is to think about what was neoliberalism. Like, one of the core features of neoliberalism was reform of governance, right? Which is this introduction of, you know, sort of markets or pseudo market structures in the governance of public institutions, for instance. So pseudo markets into the NHS. I work in a university, you know, the university sector, higher education sector has been absolutely destroyed by by what you might call audit culture, where you've got like these constant audits of your activity in order to try to fit the results of those audits into these pseudo market forms of governance, right? And there's only one reason you do that. You do that to try to transform the way people think about themselves and understand themselves in the world. So Margaret Thatcher famously said, economics is the tool, but the goal is to change the human soul. And she said, so the change in the human soul is to change the way we think about ourselves. When you participate in a competitive market, you have to behave as though you are a selfish, rationalizing, autonomous individual whose material interests are inversely related to other people's material interests. That's what a competitive market is. You know, you're forced to behave in that way. I am, as an academic, I'm forced to behave in that way, as though my colleagues are actually my competitors. And, you know, if you do that enough, it starts to become the common sense view of like what the world is. The world is made up of these selfish, rational, autonomous individuals delinked from everybody else, out to maximize their utility at everybody else's expense. That was the project to reform us that neoliberalism and Thatcherism set out to do. So the aim is, you know, we have to reverse that in some way, right? We have to create institutions that create different sorts of subjectivities, what we might call democratic subjectivities, who see other people as like, you know, not as a problem, but as the potential allies for solutions. Do you know what I mean? Joyful institutions, we may say, to come back to that Spinoza's conversation we were having earlier. And so that's why I'm interested in the commons, right? Because the commons is about, it's about like collective ownership but collective governance at the same time, right? And so the participation, the idea is if we can spread the common sector of the economy, right, more and more people will have experience of interacting with commons, being commoners, collectively governing commons. Right. And that could be like, I'm talking in terms of workers' co-ops as well as all sorts of other sorts of commons, you know, and that sets up, that means that we develop these sort of democratic subjectivities, which basically mean that the democratization, the wider democratization of wider society is much more possible, right? And so this idea of public common partnerships, it's obviously it's an attempt to reverse engineer public-private partnerships. These PPPs, a subsection of PPPs was PFI, private finance initiatives. You know,
and very quickly, what happened with the PFIs?
Yeah, PFIs and PPPs. Basically, they're a way of introducing a financial logic into the governance of public sector, right? So basically, it's about private public partnerships would be that a PFIs would be that the private sector would build a new hospital, say, right? And then they would run that hospital, and then the state would pay off that initial capital outlay. It would pay it off over 30 years. And so the company involved gets this guaranteed return, massively inflated, costs something like between 2 and 3 times more to do it that way than to finance it and do it as the state, basically. But it pushes the cost off the balance sheet, so it looks better for the state. You know, and the purpose of doing that is that that the financial sector then exercises its discipline and creates efficiencies, right? But when we look into those efficiencies, what those efficiencies really mean are you offload costs onto others, right? So when we look at PFI schemes, what you see is that, you know, workers sacked, reemployed under worse conditions and less wages. The costs, those efficiencies are being just offloading those costs onto workers. Service users, they get much worse service provision. You know, wider society has to pick up all of the costs, etc. The costs get offloaded. So basically, these are fake efficiencies. That's what financialization is. It's fake efficiencies, pushing costs onto those either people or areas such as the environment, which basically has not got the ability anymore to fight back and assert its own interests. And so that's what public-private partnerships are, basically. That's what they're there for. And so public common partnerships is the opposite. It's like we're going to protect commons and workers' co-ops and, you know, cooperatively run energy companies, etc. We're going to protect them from the discipline of the financial sector so that they don't have to offload their costs onto the environment or onto other people, etc. And so the way we did that is we're trying to think through that the public in cooperation with commons and jointly governing these projects, right? Our whole aim is that like the surpluses that come from a public common partnership, right? The profits or the surpluses, right? After operating costs, they go into financing other public common partnerships. So it's an attempt to build a self-expansive dynamic into the commons, right? To counter the self-expansive dynamic of capital. I'll explain that. But capital is basically, you get some money, resources, you invest them, right, in order to get a return. And the return's got to be like 2-3% at least. You have to meet or beat market expectation. But you take that surplus and you don't go and spend it on a Maserati or perhaps a little bit of that. That surplus gets reinvested into new capital projects. And so that the dynamic is always to spread capital. You know, capitalism as we know it has to grow by like, you know, around 3% a year, or we say we're in recession, and that's compound growth, right? So there has to be like 3% more and more services, etc., provided by capitalism every year, right? Which is why it's incompatible. Capitalism is incompatible with solving the climate crisis, basically.
Life on this planet.
Yeah. But like, basically, you know, that is a way in which more and more areas of life have to come under this, what you might call the capital circuit, or, you know, be enmeshed in capitalist social relations. Our idea is you have a similar dynamic built into the commons. So more and more commons, the common sector expands, so more and more activity and social activity and life can be exercised under the commons, right? And you do that by this mechanism of the surplus of any public common partnerships gets invested into what we call the circuit of the commons. So it goes and capitalizes new public common partnerships, basically.
And are there examples of that? Is this, what state of development are these, is this, this, these ideas?
Well, basically, this is something me and a friend, Bertie Russell, have been developing over the last couple of years. And we have examples of like partial fulfillments of this. So there's an energy company in Wolfhagen in Germany, which has got this very many of these characteristics apart from the reinvestment of surplus. But it's like, basically, it's jointly governed by like what you might call a commons association, and then jointly governed by the local state. And in our model, we'd also have joint governance by other stakeholders. So there'd be a three-way sort of governance model. So like, you know, we can see where there's different areas, but we've sort of put this together. And at the moment, we're talking with three different, we've got like three projects which we're trying to get a sort of proof of concept off the ground, right? We've got three different projects which we are trying to push through, one of which looks as though it's gonna happen. Unfortunately, I can't go into any details because it's all embargoed at the moment. And so that's the idea, is we want to do a sort of proof of concept of this idea, right? And it would be proof of concept more of the sort of joint governance structure and how it might work, etc., with the idea that, you know, we put four or five of these projects in place before trying to make it into a national scheme. Now I've got 5 years to do this, so it's fine. Before, we were really rushing to try and think about it. Obviously, I don't think Boris is going to go for this, but there are local authorities who are looking for ways in which, you know, this solves certain problems, this model solves certain problems for local authorities, in particular this problem of them, you know, the problem of the right to buy, for instance. You know, that you do public spending and all of a sudden it gets snapped up by the private sector and therefore out of the realms of any future sort of municipal government authority to do anything with that. So now in the private sector. So we want to do the same. Public spending, but it gets in the common sector so that any future authority, local authority, cannot get at it and reverse the process. Do you know what I mean? Right. That's sort of, so we're hopeful that that will be an attractive thing to sort of build up as a proof of concept. And then maybe, you know, you might have a government which was susceptible to, you know, rolling this out on a sort of national scale with that national scale backing. Who knows? Who knows?
Well, it's just such an important area, neglected area, the commons, and even the idea that most people have in their head, if they have one, about it, is the tragedy of the commons, which isn't actually true, but it's such I think such a fertile way of framing and thinking about, you know, social good and the environment and so forth. Yeah. And I wish you the very best of success with this project. As you save a little bit of time, but you know, we need a flowering of different governance and ways of approaching and thinking about, you know, building organizations to create social capital. And I wish you the very best, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, I really enjoyed it, actually. It was a good discussion.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.